Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Did you know that 100 years ago this month, after the Paris Olympics of 1924, Ireland staged its own Olympics in Dublin, the Tailteann Games? It was an attempt by the new Free State to revive an ancient tradition and showcase a distinctively Irish sporting and cultural heritage. One of the first decisions made by the new Free State government was to stage these games and ultimately to give 10,000 punts to the GAA to renovate Croke Park to stage the opening and closing ceremonies. Join me to discuss the significance of the 1924 events is Dermot Ferreter, Professor of Modern History at UCD. There we were, Dermot, just dusting ourselves down after the Civil War, struggling with getting a functioning state up and running, and they decided to make a big, bold statement like this.
Yeah, the timing might seem bizarre on one level because there were such existential questions about the survival of the state, and there was much fraughtness in relation to the rawness of the Civil War still. But the idea of reviving these ancient games actually predated the Civil War. There was a notion in early 1922 that this would be a good way to introduce the Free State to the world, but also to make connections between the Irish at home and abroad. There's a lot of focus on Irish race conventions during the War of Independence period because they want to tap into that sense of a network of people with Irish heritage and Irish connections nationwide. And they also wanted to promote the sporting aspect of that. And the proposal in 1922 was quite far advanced. The idea was that it would be held over 16 days in August 1922. But what happened, of course, was the occupation of the forecourts in April 1922 and ultimately the outbreak of the Civil War in June 1922. So it was scuppered, but it was revived again. And that had much to do, of course, with the determination of particular individuals who were not just associated with that period, but an earlier period of emphasis on cultural revival and focus on the language and traditional heritage and so on.
And when it did take place, this was no rinky-dink little affair. It brought a quarter of a million people into Dublin. The place was bursting.
It was hugely ambitious. Now, there were sceptical voices about whether or not this was feasible at all. Where would these people be accommodated? Did we have the infrastructure to deal with this? What scale of competition could be staged and what venues could be used. And they really marshalled every available resource that they had. It was partly about redeveloping Croke Park. It was also about taking advantage of people coming home from the Paris Olympics. Because if you think about the journey in those days, the Paris Olympics had been 2 weeks previously. If you were going back to the States, for example, you would be going via Cove. So there was an opportunity to snatch those athletes at Cove and persuade them to come to Dublin and prolong their athletic summer.
But were people competing in these games not supposed to be of Irish descent or have Irish
connection?
Oh, they
were. Oh, yeah. It was very much the idea of reviving this ancient Irish tradition. So the rule was that you had to be Irish or of Irish heritage. But you can bend rules, Philip, if you have a concern with box office receipts. So they got terrific athletes like Richmond Eve, the diver. You had Harold Osborne, who was one of these brilliant all-round American athletes. They didn't necessarily have Irish lineage. Johnny Weissmuller.
Before he champion was Tarzan?
Oh, well before he was Tarzan. But
he did. A big catch nonetheless.
Well, he got a taste of Dublin Zoo, so that may well have influenced the subsequent trajectory of his career because he was swimming in a repurposed pond in Dublin Zoo. This is what I mean about making the best of the venues that you have. And also the Phoenix Park was used and the range of competition and events was extraordinary because it wasn't just about sport, it was also about culture and dance and storytelling and painting.
Now, no cricket, no rugby, no hockey, but pretty much everything else.
Absolutely. You could not have these denationalising plagues being presented as Irish sports. And this was largely to do with J.J. Walsh. J.J. Walsh was the dynamo behind the organisation of the Games. He was also the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs. He was a very formidable Cork man, very arrogant, very determined, and very energetic. And he was also steeped in GAA. And this Tailteann Games in 1924 is partly about privileging the position of the GAA in Irish society, including the redevelopment of Croke Park. But he was adamant that there could not be sports that were not of Irish lineage.
But it wasn't all about Gaelic games because, I mean, there was a bizarre range of sports in there, including motorboating out in Dunleary.
But you see, this is the interesting thing about the mix of antiquity and modernity. There's a big push to present this as the revival of something that's not just ancient, but was about the Irish leading the way athletically in ancient times. That the Irish had actually started the Olympics through these Talchin Games well before the Greeks. That we had Fionn MacCool, they had Achilles, we were there before that. That the Irish had invented chess, which is also an event in the Talchin Games. The 32 pieces representing the 32 counties. There's much legend, of course, and myth.
Yes, I was going to say, how much evidence is there to support
these
claims?
They didn't need evidence. There was a playwright who's not very well known now, T.H. Nally, who was a fervent nationalist. Okay. He was commissioned to write an official history of the Talchin Games in 1924, and he was promoting these ideas of the Irish having led the way athletically. So it wasn't just about nationalism, it was about athletic pursuit and nationalism going hand in hand.
Do you mind if we just take a little diversion down a cul-de-sac temporarily from 1924 to the original games and what they were based on? They stopped when the Normans arrived, but it had been a big deal for a long time.
It had, and it was about a gathering of the clans, you know, and it was also associated with Meath because the location for the games was near the Hill of Tara. And, you know, you'll appreciate, again, the importance of that as a sacred site. But the idea was that people could put their differences aside and their political differences aside and focus not just on athletic pursuits, but also learning. And entertainment.
Yes, there was poetry, there was song,
there was all of that.
But there was also, if again the annals are correct on this, there was 150 aside hurling matches, and there was mad.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been codified and disciplined to the extent that they became. But it's a very ambitious undertaking in 1924, not just to resurrect that idea and marry it to a political message. We're a new state. W.T. Cosgrave would have opened the games officially in Croke Park in 1924, in August 1924, and he made the point that we're not a colony. You know, we are now showing to the world that we can stand on our own two feet and that we have this particular lineage which surpasses any other lineage in the world. So it's really exaggerated, but it's also about state building and trying to use sport as a way to build a particular confident identity.
And because it was so associated with one political party, the other fella, what attitude did he take?
Well, Sinn Féin, anti-treaty Sinn Féin, produced a pamphlet in 1924 to coincide with the games in which they encouraged the public to boycott it on the grounds that those who were travelling from abroad to Ireland would not see the motherland as we wish to see it. In other words, they weren't going to an Irish Republic. They weren't going to a 32-county Irish Republic.
We're not ready for you yet.
I mean, that message to boycott was not adhered to. I mean, an estimated 140,000 spectators attended the various events, and they were very attracted to the modern events. I mean, the Free State Air Corps, the new Air Corps, staged races in the air, and there were the motorsports that you mentioned as well that attracted competitors from Northern Ireland, and they were the ones that really galvanised the crowds. So, you know, you had that sense that you weren't, despite the political opposition, and there was concern within cabinet even that the games might be disrupted by the anti-treaty side, but they made the clever decision to release the remaining anti-treaty prisoners before the games opened so that they wouldn't become a focus during the games. So those calls by Sinn Féin, they were really overrode by the public enthusiasm for what was on display, because this was something that they could, particularly during very difficult times. 1924 was a very difficult year, and there was a very stringent attitude to public finances. It was a diversion. There was enormous fun and entertainment available, and people really embraced that idea.
Did De Valera ever get behind them, though? Because
he did. He did.
Come up with it.
They were staged again in 1928. The Olympics was in Amsterdam that year, which again facilitated the Talchin Games in some ways, and he did attend some of them. But by 1932, when Fianna Fáil are now in power, they see this as very much associated with a political opposition.
But if memory serves, in 1932 the games were in Los Angeles.
Yeah, so again, it wasn't practical.
So geography really didn't favour.
Geography worked against Ireland at that stage. But you also have to remember there were not a lot of divisions within Irish sporting bodies that had become in some respects more pronounced. The National Athletic and Cycling Association had split, for example, by that time. Okay. And there were disputes about jurisdiction. And of course, partition had a huge impact on sport. And one of the advantages of the Talchin Games in 1924 was again to try and bypass that by emphasising the global sporting identity and, you know, attracting people from America and Australia and New Zealand and even South Africa, that you could bring them all in to try and get rid of the notion of borders when it came to sport.
How much did it all cost?
Well, there was a loan of £7,500 made available to the Tailteann Committee, on top of the £10,000 that had been made available for the repurposing of Croke Park. There was a dispute then about the payment of the money when the Tailteann Committee came looking for their £7,500. They only got £4,500 because the revenue commissioners, who always get their way, they took £3,000 in entertainment tax. And JJ Walsh had argued very forcefully, even as a cabinet minister, that this should not have been applied because this was an event which is about the promotion of the welfare of the country and the reputation of the country. But revenue was adamant because there was a tax at that stage on the receipts as a result of people attending these particular events, and they took a fair whack.
How well organised do you think it actually was? Was it a bit rough and ready? I mean, I ask because by way of comparison, in the 1990s, you will remember, there was an enormous brouhaha when Gay Mitchell suggested that Ireland should pitch for the Olympic Games at some time.
Well, Lono Duffy had made that pitch even much earlier. He had been at Los Angeles in 1932 and suggested that Dublin should apply to host the Olympics. But he suggested £500,000 would need to be raised from the citizens of the Free State, and that there would have to be a new stadium built and that Phoenix Park would have to become an Olympic village. And many people laughed at him at that stage. But in 1924, they canvassed private households to accommodate people. They earmarked all of the college accommodation. They put a lot of effort through various subcommittees into transport. JJ Walsh did express a fear about visitors to Ireland being fleeced, if you can believe that, as a result of the opportunity that might be available. And there were jokes about the idea that Ireland wasn't ready for this tourist influx, because it was also about tourism. There's a very famous cartoon in 1924 in Dublin Opinion magazine, the satirical magazine, which insisted that accommodation wasn't a problem in Dublin. And they had a cartoon of the GPO, said this building held 30,000 patriots in 1916. So there's plenty of room in Dublin for people to stay. So it was something of a running joke. But I mean, people pitched in and got behind the idea that it was in their interests to try and promote that. And it was also financially beneficial for some people. But there were debts left.
Of the order of?
Well, I mean, that that £7,500 that was made available to the Tailteann Committee, I mean that was a loan. And you remember 1924 was also the year associated with the famous cut in the old age pension. So, you know, a very hard line being taken in relation to financing. So it was difficult financially. But one of the reasons why the Games ultimately became scuppered and really, after 1932, which was a damn squib, they just kind of faded away, was because it was believed that £10,000 would have to be invested every 4 years if the Games were to be a success.
It does sound, though, at least 1924 was a success and a statement about what new one-year-old country could do.
And they drafted in people like Yeats. There was a distinguished visitors committee, a very strong cultural dimension. And he addressed the opening dinner, the banquet in the Metropole Hotel, which had to be lit by candlelight because the municipal workers were on strike. Because there were a lot of labour disputes in Ireland in 1924 as well. But he was making the point again, you know, that this is about us reaching a certain maturation and that it involves a confidence and communicating a confidence. So they were trying to draw in, you know, people from different sectors and different backgrounds in order to try and promote the idea that the Free State was open for business, but also that it had recovered. And so that will is there. But
somewhere between 1924 and 1932, we lose that confidence and that self-belief.
Yeah. And I mean, you also have to consider all of the political divisions that continued and in some respects widened, and also the ongoing financial difficulties, but also international economic volatility. So there were economic questions there, but also as a state is settling down, there are fault lines that perhaps can be managed initially, but can widen partly as a result of the recovery of the anti-treaty side. And remember, you know, in the 1923 general election, anti-treaty Sinn Féin secured 28% of the vote. So there's a very sizable base of anti-treaty opinion there that doesn't really recognise the legitimacy of the state. And many of the citizens didn't recognise the legitimacy of it. And some of those differences were enlarged in subsequent years.
Very interesting nonetheless. Thank you very much, Dermot Ferreter, for taking that look back on 100 years ago. On the, pronounce it for me. I got that wrong. I
placed the Talchin wrong games.
Talchin. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Take care.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.